as I said, with filmmaker David York, who, do I have him on the line?
You do.
All right, David, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thank you.
So I was actually able to watch nearly all of your documentary this morning right before I came in. As I was describing, I don't know if you caught my intro there, but it's a bit grim.
Well, it's grim in that it paints a difficult picture of the mountain pine beetle outbreak in British Columbia and Alberta, and also projects a strong possibility that the outbreak will continue all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. But on the other hand, it's a miraculous species. The mountain pine beetle is an extraordinary creature, and you kind of have to admire it in a funny way.
One of the kind of early things that goes over in the documentary was talking about how the trees aren't sort of simply like passive victims. That there is actually that the pine trees specifically that they've been attacking have evolved in essence along with the beetle and have varieties of defenses. And you go through and explain all those. Can you talk a little bit about the ways in which trees have tried to prevent themselves and then what has actually overcome that? How has the beetle been able to come these defenses that the trees have?
Well, even backing up there from there, the mountain pine beetle and the lodgepole pine, which is its favorite host, have co-evolved over hundreds of thousands of years. And in fact, the beetle is an absolutely critical part of the natural process of forest renewal. The beetle's job is to take out over-mature 80 to 100-year pine trees, kill them. Those trees fall, they rot, providing the soil with nutrients and opening up the canopy for new trees. And then wildfire comes through and sweeps out the deadfall. And that's how pine trees have renewed themselves for millennia. So the tree's defenses are threefold. First of all, the tree has very thick bark, which is difficult for the beetle to chew its way through. Once it does, the tree expresses its pine pitch. So pine pitch kind of pours out the boreholes that the beetles have made in the tree. And for a period of a day, maybe two, the beetle finds itself kind of swimming upstream through this thick pine pitch that the tree's pouring out, trying to defend itself and seal the hole. So the beetles, when they attack a tree, they don't do it individually. They attack trees in hundreds, maybe thousands numbers. So after a couple of days, the tree literally has no more pitch with which to defend itself. So the beetle, you know, gets inside, gets under the bark. The next step of the tree's defense is to pour a very toxic version of its pine pitch into the tissue surrounding the beetle and kill off that tissue and, in effect, trap the beetle in this form of cell suicide. But if the beetle attacks in sufficient numbers, the tree simply doesn't have any defenses left. And after 48 hours or so, the tree's dead.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that really stood out for me, I mean, just listening to the way, and there's some really beautiful imagery in there as well, it made it very easy to sort of understand and gripping to follow along. Just even the story of how the beetles attack and then how the trees were defending themselves. But one of the things that stood out for me was during that process, I got a sense of just even thinking about the tree as an active defender sort of changed my perspective a little bit. I'm of course aware that trees are alive and natural things have natural defenses, but it seemed quite a bit more, I guess real is not even the right word. It just more in action. Like it was actually responding to stimuli as opposed to you think trees of like as like passive or like them defending themselves by maybe like scattering more tree seeds. But this it really made it sound like an actual sort of battleground that was going on.
Oh, it absolutely is. It's both a physical battleground in the beetle having to fight its way through the pitch, but it's also essentially a chemical warfare zone, because the pitch is very toxic to the beetles, and the sort of the chemical is called a terpene, and that's what turpentine used to be made of, and that's that really familiar scent of pine pitch that we all know. But the terpenes that sort of carry out this autonomous cell suicide around those beetles that have penetrated the bark, that's extraordinarily toxic, both for the beetle and for any eggs and larvae that follow. So you're right. It's an extraordinary defense, and the beetle can only overcome it if it attacks in mass numbers all at the same time.
And so that's a really good place to stop, actually. I'm glad that you finished that sentence with mass numbers, because that was the next thing I wanted to ask you about, flesh out a little bit more, was the types of numbers that we're talking about. I heard numbers in there in the trillions.
Yeah. Yeah. There was an extraordinary event that happened in 2004. It was always thought that while the mountain pine beetle attack was devastating in British Columbia, the rest of the country's pine forests were safe because they couldn't cross the Rockies. And there's a fellow named Peter Jackson, who's a meteorologist at the University of Northern British Columbia, and he saw these strange-looking cloud formations on his weather radar, and they would last a couple of days. And they weren't rain, and he had a suspicion that they might be insects, rented a Cessna and went out for a closer look, and he took some samples over a 1-hectare area of these clouds of beetles.
There's actually a harrowing image a little bit of him actually like opening the door of an airplane while in flight and sticking a net out the side of the window. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And he extrapolated the numbers out from his sample, and in one cloud crossing over the Rockies in a 4-day stretch in outside Prince George, he counted over 600 million beetles. And extrapolating from there over all of the flights that he knew were in the air in British Columbia that single weekend, he gets up to around 2.5 trillion beetles in the air in one weekend.
Wow. And so, like, when we're talking about the actual threat from that, I mean, numbers, when you get into something like numbers in the trillions, I mean, you can see, when you see the documentary, you'll see they show the radar image of these clouds. He has the kind of recorded image, and it really does look like a weather system moving through. But again, I think it's still like a problem of like scale. Like, we're not used to sort of thinking about insect numbers in the trillions, and we're not used to thinking about the numbers of individual trees in a massive forest. So can you give me and the listeners just a little bit of an idea about like the type of area that's been affected so far, and then the type of area that potentially could be affected?
Oh, sure. So the outbreak took off in British Columbia in 1999, and the sort of peak outbreak years were 1999 through 2007. And in that period of time, the mountain pine beetle took out 18 million hectares of pine trees. Now, that is an area equal to the provinces of Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. So that's essentially hollowing out the central interior, the northern half of the central interior of British Columbia, and denuding it of its pine forests.
It should also be noted as well is that obviously the pine beetles don't respect things like national parks. So this isn't just going after, reducing income for loggers or anything like that. I mean, we're literally talking about either between the beetles or between the attempts to contain them, like clear-cutting areas the size of Nova Scotia, you're saying?
Yeah, well, the beetle outbreak took out 18 million hectares of trees the size of Nova Scotia, New Brunswick. Mm-hmm. Not all of that has been clear-cut,
right,
although much of it has, which is a part I'm sure we'll get to later. But yeah, absolutely. One of the first nodes of the outbreak that was noticed was in Tweedsmuir Park, which is a spectacular, pristine wilderness area in the northern interior of BC, and that basically doesn't have any more pine trees in it anymore.
And so what's going to happen to those spaces? I mean, now that we have big swaths, are these kind of like permanent biohazard areas, or they just, is it just going to turn into kind of farmland for now? What is actually happening to these massive areas that are cut down to try and contain the infestation?
Okay. Well, the first thing that the first kind of dilemma that the province of British Columbia and its logging industry faced is they looked at these millions of hectares of dead pine trees, and they knew that those pine trees had economic value as timber for a period of about 5 to 8 years before they fell and rotted. So the province of British Columbia's first response was to increase the cut block size, lower the stumpage fees, and set the logging industry loose on this vast area of dead pine trees. So, you know, off they went. And over the course of it, there was a massive investment in milling infrastructure to the extent that 5 of the world's top 10 sawmills are in the northern interior of BC. And they're pretty much solely devoted to processing beetle-killed pine. So where we stand now is this clear-cutting activity has been going on for, you know, call it a decade, and these mills are 3 to 5 years away from exhausting that supply of dead timber. What's happened is because that supply is almost exhausted, those mills have started cutting other species of conifer. They've started going after spruce, and they've started going after fir. So it really is a kind of a full-scale attack on the conifer landscape in British Columbia that's going on. The impact of that is disastrous. There was a recent study that said there are 70% fewer moose, for instance, in the pine beetle outbreak area. The flooding situation is disastrous because a healthy pine tree pumps 8 gallons of water per hour during spring melt. So if you take all of those pine trees out of the mix, it plays havoc with the watershed. So the Fraser had a horrific flooding year this year. They're looking at century floods now happening every 7 to 15 years in the Fraser, which is a disaster. The pine tree is also a keystone species in that environment, which means it's a species that all life depend on. So if you take out the pine tree, it's got disastrous impacts on songbirds, on fish, other plants, ungulates. It really is quite devastating what's going on.
Hi, David. This is Kevin. I've been aware for years that the pine beetle infestation is one of Canada's really sort of unknown ecological catastrophes. My understanding has been, though, that in the past, cold winters helped to curb the population of the beetles. And in fact, you know, that increasingly mild winters now are contributing to the population explosion. Can you speak to that?
You're quite right, Kevin. So the natural cycle of forest life, every 25, 30 years, historically, there was a warmish winter and a hot, dry summer. The beetle population would spike. It would then have the numbers to take out those old, over-mature standing pine and, you know, regenerate the forest in the way that I've talked about. But you could always count on a stretch of cold weather, basically below minus 35 or below for 4 or 5 days. That's enough to kill, you know, 90 to 95% of the beetles. Also, the beetles have an extraordinary defense. In the mid-fall, they pump the water out of their larvae and replace it with they use trizone chemistry and replace the water with essentially antifreeze that helps them overwinter. But if there's a good cold snap right around Halloween, that will be fatal to every single mountain pine beetle in the forest.
And
the problem is that we haven't had those kind of, they haven't had those kind of winter conditions in British Columbia since the early 90s.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what's happened is cold weather, normal winters, always acted as a break on the population. So the population would spike for a year or two, and then it would kind of fall back drastically. That cold weather break has gone. So there's nothing in the natural cycle to restrain these beetle population outbreaks.
And what has changed also that suddenly allows these beetles to cross the Rockies? I knew that, I always knew that was a natural barrier, but I never knew. I'm very interested to find out why they're suddenly able to surmount that barrier.
Numbers.
Just numbers, is
mass
it?
Mass numbers.
Right.
Once you get up north of, there's also the Rocky Mountain Plateau around, I don't know if you're familiar with the area, around Prince George, over to Chetwynd, B.C. There's actually a low pass, which is called Pine Pass. And so that's only at around 3,500, 4,000 feet. So that's where the beetles blew over Pine Pass.
Oh.
And they simply, there were so many of them that a sizable enough proportion of them landed that were able to take root in the pine forest on the other side of the Rockies.
All right. Well, I mean,
that's been the game changer. You know, now the mountain pine beetle is established east of the Rockies at an endemic level. It's there now. So all that needs to happen is a period of those warmer winters and hot, dry summers, and the outbreak will take off again.
I'm afraid we are actually getting pretty close to out of time, but I wanted to give you a chance. Was there any good news at all from this? Any hope? Are we just terribly concerned today? Is there anything looking up as far as strategies that are being developed or methodology? Does anybody have a lead to get a handle on this?
Well, the short answer is no. the short answer is no, because the beetle spends all but 2 days of its life cycle under the bark of a tree. And the only way to get at it is to cut individually infected trees down and burn them before the beetles emerge next summer. So that's, when we're talking millions, if not billions of trees. So that's a kind of Herculean task. The thing, though, that we should take away from it is that it's not an invasive species. The beetle has always been in the forest doing this job. It's had periodic outbreaks in the past. This is natural, right? So what we're looking at right now is the fact that nature is, in effect, a more efficient logger than people are.
Well,
this is what the beetle's always done.
One of the things that I really appreciated about it was that there was a lot of really interesting imagery, a lot of close-up shots. So you really made it, when I was watching, you really made it very easy to sort of visualize exactly what it was that you were talking about. So I would definitely recommend it for folks. It will be airing. The first shot will be this coming Thursday, April the 4th at 8 p.m. That's 8:30. Oh, sorry. Was that the actual time? Did I get?
Yeah, no, you got that right.
It's April 4th. Okay, so yeah, 8 o'clock, and then it's the replaying. I think the following week or something like that. But
it's replaying on Saturday on Newsworld.
That's right.
Saturday.
So, do you want to? Aside from that, they can check that on CBC's "The Nature of Things" with David Suzuki Thursday, April 4th at 8. Do you want to give people any information for a website they can look for information or a way to contact you if they're interested?
Well, there is. CBC does have a good website. The Nature of Things website is up, and they have a mini site with some additional material on. So if you just go to Nature of Things website, you'll see it.
Okay. Well, we'll also have links up to all of that on the post after the show as well. So if anyone doesn't have access to a computer now, just go and check our website later. You'll be able to find links to all this information as well. Thank you so much, David York, for joining us today on behalf of the film The Beetles Are Coming.
That's great. Thank you.